Okay, so welcome everyone. As I continue on our theme where we're exploring stories and teachings from early Buddhism, and this week I'm giving it's a talk, but it's sort of more an exploration, really, on the Bhayabharava Sutta, otherwise known as the Sutta of Fear and Dread. So how I'm going to do this is I will be reading some excerpts from the sutta. I'll be having some thoughts about the sutta, maybe bringing out some themes, and it's interesting because this is a sutta where the Buddha doesn't directly give a teaching to the person that he's talking to. Quite often people will come and they'll ask for a teaching, or he'll give people a teaching. We had the Satipatthana Sutta last week where the Buddha's giving an address to the community of monks, and he's giving a lot of very detailed instructions and advice about their practice of mindfulness, almost every aspect of mindfulness, bringing it to every aspect of your life and your mind and making it a way to insight. So this one is interesting, I think, because it's much more the Buddha sharing his practice, sharing his experience. So he is still teaching, but he's teaching indirectly. And it's, yes, to me it has a much more personal feel. He's just responding to the person who asks him some questions in a very real way. So I'm just going to read you the opening of the sutta to start us off. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jetta's Grove. Then the Brahmin Janusani went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said, Master Gotama, when clansmen have gone forth from the home life into homelessness, out of faith in Master Gotama, do they have Master Gotama for their leader, their helper and their guide? And do these people follow the example of Master Gotama? That is so, Brahmin, that is so. When clansmen have gone forth from the home life into homelessness out of faith in me, they have me for their leader, their helper and their guide. And these people follow my example. But Master Gotama, remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice, and it is hard to enjoy solitude. One would think the jungles must rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he has no concentration. That is so, Brahmin, that is so. Remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice, and it is hard to enjoy solitude. One would think the jungles must rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he has no concentration. So that's the opening. So basically we have a situation when we've got a Brahmin who clearly is interested in the Buddha, in his teaching, in his sangha, and how it all works. And, you know, got some doubts about it, you know. And he's wanting to know, well, how much support, you know. What is the role that the Buddha plays when people do take that big step going into the homeless life? Yeah, you know, does he continue to be their leader? Does he help them? Does he guide them? You know, so it's the ongoing sort of spiritual guidance and support. You know, is that something that he offers? And also, what is it that the people who go forth do? You know, do they follow the example of the Buddha? Do they live in the same way as the Buddha? You know, and in particular, he's interested in whether they go into the forests, into these jungle places, and practice. If they're going to practice in solitude, in seclusion, you know. And, you know, on a physical level, those conditions would be hard to live in, hard to practice in. But also, you know, he's bringing out that there's also a challenge to do that emotionally and mentally. You know, and very much his anxiety. So there's a kind of sense there that he's sort of doubting, you know, whether it would be possible to do that without having, without having to experience, you know, difficult mental states. And there seems to be, like, in there almost a fear of losing one's mind, going mad. So he's voicing his own anxiety and fear, I think. There's a sense of being tempted to follow the Buddha's path, but not sure whether it's going to be too challenging, whether he would be able to cope with that kind of lifestyle, how much support he would get if he was to follow the Buddha. And also doubting himself, whether or not, you know, he's up for it. What would happen if he does? And there's a lot of fear and anxiety in that, you know, that fear of losing his mind. Yeah. So I think as well as fear and dread in this sutta, there is a sort of underlying theme of doubt, actually, in what we do working with doubt, which you see getting played out throughout the sutta. So I think it's quite interesting that the Brahmin, you know, so he would have been quite high up socially and spiritually, have quite a lot of status, but he's just coming to the Buddha, talking to him, being very open, very honest, making himself vulnerable, voicing his fears, and that the Buddha seems to just respond on the level that he needs him to, you know. So he's kind and honest, he doesn't dismiss or patronise, he acknowledges, you know, that, you know, the Brahmin's fears have got some justification, you know, and that practice is hard, you know, that it is hard. Practicing in the forest, seclusion is hard. That solitude, it's not always easy to enjoy solitude. So I think that's, to me, is really heartening that he's sort of just like saying, yeah, the path is hard, you know, we will find it hard to do this in a very sort of straightforward way. And then what he says next is, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too considered thus. Remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest are hard to endure. Seclusion is hard to practice, and it is hard to enjoy solitude. One must think the jungles would rob a bhikkhu of his mind if he has no concentration. So he's admitting that he had all those same doubts, all those same challenges, you know, early on in his practice. So I think that's quite humanising. I think it also reminds us, you know, that the Buddha is just like us, a human being, experienced all the same kinds of difficulties, challenges, mental states that we work with. Because it's very easy to think of the Buddha as enlightened and somehow so far above us, and to sort of forget that element. You know, we can idealise him, and, you know, obviously there is a level where, you know, he is so much above us, he's an example, and he inspires us. But I think also it helps to keep in mind the human, you know, the man who struggled, the man who worked with all the things that we did. And I think that's one of the things that's really, to me, quite delightful about reading some of these early stories and suttas, that you really get a picture of the Buddha as a man, you know, travelling around, meeting people, teaching people, all different kinds of people, different kinds of interactions, you know, and things that he found difficult along the way, you know. So then the Buddha shares, you know, that after he'd had the same kind of doubts, you know, some of his thought processes, yeah. So I consider thus, whenever recluses or Brahmins unpurified in bodily conduct resort to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest, owing to the defect of their unpurified bodily conduct, These good recluses and Brahmins evoke unwholesome fear and dread. But I do not resort to remote jungle thicket resting places, unpurified in bodily conduct. I am purified in bodily conduct. Seeing in myself this purity of bodily conduct, I found great solace in dwelling in the forest. And then he has a series of reflections about, in a way, what he sees might be the causes that could lead to one going into those mental states of fear and dread in particular. Though I think it also covers all the other kinds of unskillful mental states that we may get into. But he's making a very clear link between one's actions, because how it goes on is, it's, you know, he considers if we're unpurified in verbal conduct, in mental contact, covetous and full of lust, with a mind of ill will and intentions of hate, overcome by sloth and torpor, overcome with restlessness and unpeacefulness in mind. So that's very clearly referencing the traditional five hindrances. And he goes on, other things that one might bring that might be causes for Brahmins or recluses to experience fear and dread would be being uncertain and doubting, given to self-praise and disparagement of others, being subject to alarm and terror, being desirous of gain, honour and renown, being lazy and wanting in energy, being unmindful, not fully aware, being unconcentrated with a straying mind, being devoid of wisdom, or being a driveller, as the translation says. So it's quite interesting because he makes that clear connection, I suppose, between our ethical practice and our mental states and all the things that we're working with. But also with each reflection, he's also considers that he is purified, he isn't subject to those things, you know, so therefore it shouldn't be a problem for him, you know. And actually when he's talking in response to each of those, he will say at the end, you know, well, I am purified in bodily conduct, I am purified in verbal conduct, I am purified in mental conduct, I am uncovetousness, I have a mind of loving kindness, I am without sloth and torpor, I have a peaceful mind, I have gone beyond doubt, I am not given to self-praise and disparagement of others, I am free from trepidation, no longer subject to alarm and terror, I have few wishes, I am energetic, I am established in mindfulness, I am possessed of concentration, and I am possessed of wisdom. So these are all things that he's considering, and therefore he thinks that if he does go into the remote jungle and forest places, he should be able to find great solace in dwelling in the forest. The next sort of thoughts he has, I consider thus, about there being specially auspicious nights to be practicing, and he wonders if he went to dwell in such awe-inspiring, horrifying abodes as orchard shrines, woodland shrines and tree shrines, perhaps I might encounter that fear and dread. So he has that wonder what would happen if he did do that. And then in a way challenges himself to test it out. So he then does, on those specially auspicious nights, he dwelt in such awe-inspiring places as the orchard shrines, the woodland shrines and tree shrines. And then this is quite interesting. What he says is, and while I dwelt there, a wild animal would come up to me, or a peacock would knock off a branch, or the wind would rustle the leaves. I thought, what now if this is the fear and dread coming? I thought, why do I dwell always expecting fear and dread? Okay. So that's, to me that's interesting, because it's not that he's just immediately experiencing the fear and dread, but he has this anxiety about what happens if I do. Is it coming? Is it not coming? So it's actually an example of the Buddha, I would say, experiencing Papantia, the kind of, not the experience, but the thoughts that we have, you know, which I'm sure must be familiar to all of us in our own practice, yeah? So there's something quite determined, maybe even a little bit willful, about the Buddha thinking, you know, I'm going to go and practice on these auspicious nights, you know, in these particularly horrifying, awe-inspiring places, you know, and the sense that, well, I don't, you know, I am purified in all these things, I'm concentrated, I have wisdom, all these things, so in a way he's not expecting to experience those things. But at the same time, he still has that doubt, you know, what if now, if this is the fear and dread coming? You know, but then he catches himself doing it, you know, he says, why do I dwell always expecting fear and dread? So there's a certain amount of awareness of his mental states. You know, just noticing, oh, this is what he's doing. And when he has that awareness and asks himself that question, he then asks himself another question. What if I subdue that fear and dread while keeping the same posture that I am in when it comes upon me? So he's had that anxiety about what happens if fear and dread comes, is this the fear and dread coming? He's aware of that tendency, that habit, why do I dwell always expecting the fear and dread? And then he, in a way, comes up with a strategy or a way of working with it to see, you know, what would happen if he just stays in the same posture, if it comes upon him. So I think there's a clear acknowledgement, you know, that he does experience these things, and, you know, he also has fear of experiencing these things at that stage in his life. And then it goes much more explicit, because he does describe experiencing them, and he does describe, you know, trying to practice with them in the way that he resolved on. While I walked, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither stood, nor sat, nor lay down, till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I stood, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor sat, nor lay down, till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I sat, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked, nor stood, nor lay down, till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor stood nor sat down till I had subdued that fear and dread. So he clearly experienced the fear and dread, and experienced it not just as a momentary thing, that he needed to actually sit with it, stand with it, lie with it, walk with it, until he's found a way of subduing it. He's talking about the four traditional postures of practicing mindfulness there, of, you know, sitting, standing, walking, lying down. That's actually referenced in the Satipatthana Sutta as, you know, the postures for practicing mindfulness. And it's basically, you know, whatever you're doing, whether you're sitting, whether you're lying down, whether you're moving about, you know, we have our minds, we still have the same mental states, whatever position we happen to be in, we still need to work with them. So it's not just that we sit down to meditate and that's it, and then we go off for the rest of our lives and we don't have those mental states to work with. We don't have those habits and tendencies to work with. So there's that acknowledgement you need to do it in all those different postures. And there's also something about staying with something, not pushing it away, because quite often when we have experiences or feelings or emotions that are difficult and challenging, what we want to do is run away from them or deny them or suppress them, push them away, distract ourselves. And what he did is he just decided to just stay with them in that posture. Yeah. And it's quite interesting that, or certainly my experience in practice, is that when I'm resisting something, it doesn't go away. It just gets bigger in a way, or comes back and comes back. when I actually have that sense of turning towards something, just kind of opening towards it, being receptive, surrendering in a way, that's when the truly deep transformation happens. And there is a way that sometimes I can let go of a very deep ingrained habit or fear or view, just by, in a way, embracing it, being with it. So it's quite interesting that the Buddha, after that, gives a whole discussion of the sequence of the mental states that arise after he has done that, which include him going through the dhyanas, having insights very similar in a way to the description we have of his enlightenment. So I will sort of touch on some of that as well, just to give us a flavour. And I've just lost my sutta. Where's it gone? Okay. So, after he's done that, sitting, walking, standing, lying down with the fear and dread, he then says to the Brahmin, well, there's some recluses and Brahmins who perceive day when it's night and night when it's day, and I say that on their part this is an abiding delusion. But I perceive night when it is night and day when it is day. Rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, a being not subject to delusion has appeared in the world for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the good welfare and happiness of gods and humans. It is of me, indeed, that rightly speaking this should be said. So he's saying that he's now at a place where he's not deluded, you know, where he sees things as they are, and also that as a result of that, you know, he's a being that, you know, is there for the welfare and happiness of the world. And then what he does is he just describes his mental states, how he got to that place in a way. So he's had the fear and the dread, but he stayed with it. And then tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first dhyana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And then he basically describes himself going through the second dhyana, the third dhyana, the fourth dhyana, the sort of states of mind. And from that place, he begins to direct his mind to particular knowledges and has particular insights. So in a way, what the description is in the early part of the sutta is that he's working with his unskillful mental states, he's working with all the hindrances and everything else, but by staying with, you know, quite extreme, difficult, challenging states, he gets to a place of mindfulness, of concentration. He does manage to go beyond the hindrances. So I think we can have that experience in our meditation practice, that every time we allow ourselves to actually explore, stay with a particularly difficult aspect of our experience or a particular habit, something gets integrated, something gets released, and then we may have these really quite concentrated, quite blissful experiences of meditation. Certainly, there's a certain period of my life where that would be happening, and then from that place it was almost like my psyche could think, oh, maybe now you can deal with this. And I'd have something else to deal with, and when I'd work through with it, then I'd get into all these blissful states. Now it's much more even, and but I think there is a link between actually allowing ourselves to experience and explore the difficult side, that, you know, and then being able to let go of it, being able to see through things, move on, you know. And there's a lot of energy in, well, there's a lot of energy in a lot of the hindrances, say, that we can transform. it's interesting that you could transform most of those into really positive states. You know, there's energy and restlessness and anxiety that you could be using in a positive way. Sloth and torpor could become calm. You know. Well, the ill will, that thing where you're sort of seeing all the faults in yourself and in others, that could be transformed into wisdom, you know. So there's the potential, the seeds within any state that we might actually see as being quite negative or unskillful or something we don't like, if we're willing to go there and explore it, and have that tireless energy aroused in ourselves. So that is basically talking about that process towards samadhi, towards sort of establishing ourselves in a kind of mindful state, in a calm state of mind, which traditionally is the place where we begin to turn our minds towards vipassana practice or insight practice. And one way that insight is often described is seeing things as they really are, which again is a theme that the Buddha brings out when he's sharing his experiences. But anyway, so the first knowledge he directs is the recollection of past lives, his own past lives first, and then he sees sort of past lives of others, I think. And seeing an element of conditionality, yeah. The next knowledge that he sort of turns his mind towards is it's the passing away of things coming into being and things passing away, the passing away and reappearance of beings, all beings, you know, and understanding the role of action. So in a way, this is where we get into the idea of condition co-production, that everything arises and passes away in dependence on sets of conditions, you know, and not all of those conditions are within our power to change, but what we can change are our actions and our reactions to, you know, our own past conditioning and the conditions we find ourselves in, and we can make decisions to, you know, follow the dharmic path, to be more skillful, to be more ethical, to be more aware, all those sorts of things that will be transformative. And, you know, as you know, we're told in a lot of the teachings that that will have a beneficial effect on ourselves and on others. Yeah. And then the result of when he has these knowledges is that ignorance is banished and true knowledge arose, darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent and resolute. Yes, so there's that encouragement to see if we can be diligent, ardent and resolute in our practice. Yeah. And another little quote from it: when my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the destruction of taints. So this is around the poisons. And the language that he uses here is, I directly knew as it actually is. And he keeps using that sort of phrase as a refrain, and then goes into the Four Noble Truths. So, I directly knew as it actually is, this is suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the origin of suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the cessation of suffering. I directly knew as it actually is, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And when I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated. Okay. And yeah, there's more details there, but what I think is very interesting is that refrain of I directly knew as it actually is. So very much about our experience, because we can be much in our thoughts and in concepts, And that's a very, very different experience to having the experience, knowing the experience. And that's, you know, when we're practicing the Dharma, we do need to have some kind of intellectual awareness of some of the key concepts of the Dharma, but that only takes us so far. We need to actually have a direct experience of the Dharma, and that will be a personal one. What are the particular teachings or practices that touch you, that give you a glimpse of reality, a glimpse of truth, you know, that you respond to, that inspire you, that take you further? And in fact, if you look at the sutta, we do have a direct contrast between, at the beginning, the Buddha's sharing what he thought, I considered thus, and there's that whole list about him considering, you know, that bhikkhus and or Brahmins and recluses, you know, who are still unskillful in whatever the ways are, you know, they're going to be experiencing the fear and dread, but he doesn't, he, you know, he's already overcome those things, so he has the thought that, you know, he won't. But then we actually have the example that when he decides to go into the forest, he does experience the fear and dread, and the anxiety about experiencing the fear and dread. So clearly he hadn't completely purified himself for all those things, you know, by his own criteria. So we can have a view about our own practice and our own level of attainment that may or may not be completely accurate. So it's always good to sort of test that out. And also, again, it's dependent on our conditions. Maybe we're in very positive conditions, so it's very easy to practice and be in positive mental states and be very clear. And then our lives go into meltdown in some kind of way. And then suddenly we find ourselves not able to do that, and we realise, actually, this was conditioned. You know, my mental states were conditioned. I had positive conditions. You know, it's like, you know, you go on a retreat, you might get into very, very blissed out states of mind. You may have very, very positive communications with everybody. You come back home, maybe go and visit your family, and all kinds of other stuff happens, and you realise, actually, I'm not as, you know, advanced on the path as I thought I was, because I'm still, all these old patterns I keep on repeating, my old ways of reacting and all that sort of stuff. But it's usually that it's, we go round and round. There are samskaras, so even if we go into the same stuff, we may be doing it with more awareness. You may get out of it more quickly. It may not be as deep or ingrained or embedded as it was in the past. So again, it's not to sort of blame ourselves or put ourselves down when that happens, just being aware of what's happening. Yeah. But that thing that actually, if we can see what is actually happening, if we can be honest about what is happening, if we can be with and allow ourselves to experience the whole range of our emotions, our mental states, you know, everything else like that, that's the way that we can go beyond that, you know, from the body's example. And I think we can always have that element of vipassana in our practice, whether we're sitting in meditation or whether we're out in the world interacting, to the extent that we can be honest and just see, okay, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling jealous, I'm feeling envious, this happened, that happened, you know, to just see it and name it without necessarily adding all the stories, all the other things around it, you know. I suppose it links in with the teaching that I know some of the people from our Sangha went on just this weekend on the theme of in the scene, only the scene, which again is a teaching that comes from one of these early stories. The Buddha gave this teaching to somebody, and it's all about not putting all those different layers and things onto our experience. Yeah, not the views, not the stories, you know, just being able to, you know, this is what I see, this is what I hear, this is what I'm thinking, you know. Anyway, there's a lot more one can do. I mean, for me, that's a very profound teaching I come back to again and again. But, it's being with your direct experience and being able to see things as much, as close to as they are. You know, we can practice that, we can get better at that. So anyway, the Buddha carries on and he describes, you know, his experience as he gets all these different knowledges. And basically, you know, it's like describing his process, his journey towards enlightenment, the kind of mental states he goes into. And then what's interesting, he then comes back to the Brahmin and he says, it might be that you think perhaps the recluse Gotama is not free from lust, hate and delusion even today, which is why he still resorts to remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest. You know, so it's, you know, in a way, it's something that he's encouraged as a way on the path. You know, this is going to be a very beneficial practice, you know. But again, it could be a way that you could, you know, remove yourself from life and other people and not deal with any of your issues at all, you know. But he's saying, no, that's not the case. And he's very clear that, you know, he is actually, you know, an enlightened being. And he then, what is quite interesting, says that the reason that he still continues to go into these remote jungle thicket resting places in the forest is because I see two benefits. I see a pleasant abiding for myself here and now, and I have compassion for future generations. So it's not just about the means, you know. It's not just, oh, I'm only going to do it until I get to enlightened and I don't need to do it anymore. He's actually saying it's a beneficial activity. You know, it's beneficial to me personally. You know, it's pleasant in the here and now. I suppose it helps him sustain positive mental states or whatever. But he also sees it as a compassionate act for the benefit of others. And you do get this in the early teachings very much, the idea that practicing, even if you're practicing by yourself in a remote place, is for the benefit of others. I think we can sometimes think there's the inner life, there's the outer life, and only the things that we do in the world, the actions that we have positive benefits. But he's very clearly saying, you know, that taking that time to be by yourself, to be a recluse, to work on your mental states has a beneficial effect on others and future generations. In a way, it's working with those root causes so that we don't keep on repeating those patterns, those ways of reacting, don't add more suffering into the world. So then the sutta ends with the response of the Brahmin. So I'm just going to read it. You know, it's quite traditional in his response, but to me it also encapsulates someone who's had that glimpse of the truth, that glimpse of the Dharma. Not because the Buddha gave him an actual teaching, but partly because of what the Buddha embodied and how he was and how he interacted and communicated with him. Partly by the Buddha's very open sharing of his experience and his practice. Indeed, it is because Master Gotama is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one, that he has compassion for future generations. Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. Master Gotama has made the Dharma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge, and to the Dharma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. So clearly you can see that he's deeply inspired, you know. And I think it's really helpful for us to just be open to what are the things that inspire us about the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and be really aware of how that connects with our going for refuge. You know, we wouldn't be following the Dharma path or interested or doing any of the practices if there wasn't something in them that spoke to us, to our potential, to our Buddha nature, if you want to use that language. So I encourage everyone to just allow yourself to be open and receptive, you know. That when you have the doubts, allow those doubts to be there, explore them, you know. When you have the difficult emotions, mental states, to allow them to be there, to explore them, to stay with them. You know, sometimes we might need to do something a bit more active around them, but also there's a big benefit in just seeing them as they are. And in a way, this sutta is an example of the Buddha acting as a leader and a helper, as a guide, in that indirect way, by just sharing his experience. There's something about the personal can be quite universal. You get that in stories and plays and poems and all kinds of things, don't you, that someone writes or shares or does a painting that's intensely personal or just about one particular person. You see a portrait of somebody and they've captured something that resonates with people, you know, hundreds of years later. But also we can follow the Buddha's example of it's okay to acknowledge, you know, that one is afraid, you know, that it is a challenge, that it is difficult. Yeah. And it's also okay to be confident and to own your qualities and your achievements. You know, he was quite clear about what he'd achieved and what he was going to be offering the world. So it requires courage to practice on the spiritual path. And I think everyone here must have at times experienced difficulties and had the courage to stay with it, to carry on practicing. Yeah, we do have to work with fears and anxiety and dread at times in our practice, not always, and not always extremely, but that will come up. So, you know, maybe it's reassuring to know that the Buddha also worked with those things. And maybe just to be aware of that connection between, you know, our actions in the world, our mental states. They're not random, they are conditioned, so we can actually, in a very sort of practical way, you know, affect our mental states by the kinds of acts we do with body, speech and mind. And just always to come back to our experience, our direct experience. You know, that's the way that we will see things as they are, by actually allowing ourselves to experience things rather than deny them, push them away. And a last suggestion is, if you haven't already, consider going on a solitary retreat. Even maybe not a jungle thicket, but there are plenty of places you can go. And you can take baby steps. You can go on a solitary, a lot of the retreat centres have got solitary huts on the ground, so you're not like completely in a very remote place. But maybe you want to take that plunge, like the Buddha, go into a very remote place where there's nobody about, see what happens, see the mental states that arise. Can you sit with them? Can you stand with them? Can you walk with them? Can you lie down with them? Okay. So I think I'm going to end there. And if anybody has got any thoughts or questions that came out in response to my nattering. I mean, I suppose what I would also like to say is, you know, obviously I'm not a Pali scholar. I wasn't giving a particular teaching about that in a way. I was just sharing my personal responses as someone who's trying to practice the Dharma. And I think sometimes that's all we can do, really. That's one of the benefits of Sangha, is sort of sharing our practice, learning from each other, supporting each other. And that may also involve acknowledging our vulnerabilities, you know, our fears, our anxieties. I'm going to finish there. So we've got just 13 minutes by this. So not time to go into groups, but there is time if anybody has any questions or thoughts they want to bring.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this idea of the fear and dread of coming along in the future.
Mm.
And because I've realised I don't really have that awareness when I'm in fear and dread, because I'm in it.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore I don't have that awareness that it's going to come up again.
Uh-huh.
So it's useful to just have that awareness that I am in it, because when I am in it, it's so intense, it's hard to sort of separate from the experience. I'm just in fear and dread, and I just think that's it.
Mm.
And I probably never think it's going to happen again, but of course, if I'm ready for it, but I don't know if I have actually fear and dread about the future. Fear and dread, I don't feel I have that at the moment.
Okay.
Anyway, I like the idea. I think the idea is very helpful.
But I think you've certainly got awareness that you experience fear and dread and that you're not in it at the moment, isn't it? So next time you're experiencing it, maybe there's a sense of recognition, this is fear and dread. You know, I've been here before, this is fear and dread.
Mm.
You know? Even if you're still experiencing it really intensely, if there's part of you that is aware of it, you're not totally identified with it. And I think that's a way forward when we're passing it. That's a way.
Mm.
Just naming it can be quite powerful, can't it?
Mm. Just noticing your reactions, yeah.
I think if the emotion is very strong, there, it is hard to get that clarity of mind, you know what I mean? Because you're being overtaken by something, whatever it is, anxiety, fear, whatever.
Mm.
It's easier to chat about it here and then get a nice perspective.
Yeah, well, the Buddha says it's not easy. You know, it is hard.
But it's that being able to get the perspective when you're actually up against it.
Mm.
That's what is, I guess, tricky.
Well, I think we're not always going to be able to do that, are we? We get completely overwhelmed by something, we get identified with it, we're in it. And then we have that awareness when we come out of it.
Mm.
You know. But then once we've got that awareness, that familiarity, maybe another time in the future, when we're in it, we notice, oh, I'm in it. You're still in it. You're still experiencing, but you notice you're in it. You know. And then maybe at a certain point we get to that thing that Colin was hoping, where we become aware that maybe we're about to go into it. We still go into it. But I think, you know, that's why practice is such a, you know, is something we keep on doing, and it has an effect over time. You know, particularly with our deeply ingrained patterns or particular issues, our samskaras, you know, we're not just going to stop them overnight or with a few meditations or going on a retreat, you know. But if we keep on our practice and we keep on working with it in lots of different ways, not just in that particular sit, but in how we're living our lives and, you know, and it may be that we need to do other kind of things like therapies as well to support that. Then I think we can move beyond that. I know for myself, I used to be in a perpetual state of terror, actually. And even up to quite recently, certain things could trigger this nameless anxiety and fear of catastrophe and things like that. You know, that was in a way quite unconscious and related to very early experiences. You know, and, you know, I think for much of my early life that was just what I did. I had no awareness of it. Well, I was aware what it felt like. You know. And that was a long process, but I don't do that in the same way now. And my, you know, so I do have a lot of confidence actually in practice, a lot of confidence in the Dharma, because that's what has helped me move beyond some of that. Doesn't mean to say I never experienced anxiety and fear. You know, I was on this retreat for a month in the summer, and yeah, I did do quite a lot of work with fear and anxiety, and some of that I wasn't totally aware of at first. Well, I was aware that I was coming and there were certain things that I'd felt upset and like anxious about, but at a certain point when I was sitting, I was just feeling tension and sensations in my body, and when I actually stayed with them and explored them, I realised actually this is fear, you know, or this is anger, or this is whatever. And then if I stayed with them, other stuff would come up, and I made those links between past experiences that had evoked them and had that clarity. And I think there's something about experiencing it rather than thinking about it, because you can have that intellectual awareness, oh, this happened to me, so probably da da da. But there's a certain point when you're feeling it emotionally, you're feeling it spiritually, then that's when I think the insight can cut through and change something on a much deeper level.
Inspiring.
Sorry?
Inspiring.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm just reflecting on either two things or two similar related things. It's just about not recognising a break mechanism when you want to go into a situation that induces fear and dread to work mm-hmm. with it. When that's skillful and when that's not skillful. Mm-hmm. So if I'm the type of person who goes for intensity, for example, then it's knowing when the intensity is going to do me harm, actually, rather than working with what comes up. And that could be either physically,
mm-hmm.
but then I really resonated with the losing the mind thing, you know. What if I
mm-hmm.
go too much and so that it's actually causing me
mm-hmm.
distress without going that far? So it's kind of trying to discern what's skillful and unskillful and where the break mechanism is, if I don't really have one.
I think that's a good point, and I think probably also we all have that tendency to go too far at times and not know the limits, or even a kind of like self-punishing thing, you know, to go into it when it might not be the most nurturing thing or what you need at a particular time.
It was quite a foolhardy kind of, right, let's do this. Kind
yes. Well, I mean, I think that's where awareness and spiritual awareness and wisdom and metta come in. That we need to have that self-meta, and we need to have aware, you know, the more aware we are of our patterns and whatever, then we can see, oh, this is a tendency, I have this tendency that I always need to be at the rock face in the most intense suffering and going into all my deepest stuff, you know. And if you become aware that's a tendency, then there's different ways of working with it. I mean, for me, that was a tendency, definitely. And, yeah, the Brahma Viharas, I'm doing a course on the Brahma Viharas. So Metta Bhava is part of this set of four practices, the Brahma Viharas. So you've got Metta, which is kindness, Karuna, which is compassion, Mudita, which is often translated as sympathetic joy or gladness, and then Equanimity Upekkha. For me, of all those practices, the most challenging one, and the one that I've had to really consciously, you know, stick with, has been the Mudita. You know, to be able to feel more positive about myself, about others, to rejoice in positivity, because my default was to go with the suffering or the difficulty. So I think if that is a tendency, that practice is a really helpful practice to bring in.
I think also helps what struck me this time about, I love this sutra as well, but it's like both the tone of it isn't like, oh, I'm going to do, you know, the tone is like, oh, what if I do this? What if, you know, it's quite gentle in a way, even when the Buddha himself, as a bodhisattva, was still experiencing these things. You know, it was like he was talking himself through it. I mean, what if I do this? What if I challenge this a bit? You know, it's quite gentle. And then through experiencing it himself, he then also has empathy for this Brahmin, you know, saying, oh, yes, I remember what that's like. You know, it's quite lovely, actually, the whole tone of it, isn't it?
Yes, that's
sort of guiding, but not in a harsh way.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I like about it, so thank you for articulating it so clearly.